let's talk and let's laugh, cause I got so much to tell you, so let's go kick some.
Kia ora and welcome to Kick Arts with Emma and Stephen and Kristen, proudly sponsored this month by our fabulous friends at the Dolphin Theatre. Head to dolphintheatre.org.nz to see their great lineup of shows coming up this year. Kick Arts is Aotearoa's comprehensive art show brought to you on Planet FM 104.6 and streaming live around the globe thanks to our podcast, which you can download from planetaudio.org.nz and find us on Spotify. Tonight we're joined in studio with the team from Dolphin Theatre to chat about their latest show, Every Brilliant Things. Then author Helen Ellis chats about her latest book, Being a Distant Grandchild. Then we're checking an upcoming show at the Basement Theatre called Buck Scourge, Living Nightmare. I said to Kristen before I get to that, I'm going to muck that one up, and I did. See, I'm true to form, and the night is young. To kick off the show today, Kristen and I had the pleasure of attending a preview sponsors event for And Juliet, opening next month in Auckland, then heading to Wellington and Christchurch. Here's one of my favourite tracks from it, It's My Life.
Song for the broken hearted. No silent prayer for the faith departed. And I ain't gonna be just a face in the crowd. You're gonna hear my voice when I shout it out loud. It's my life.
Ones who stood their ground.
Romeo, Romeo, Romeo.
Oh, Romeo and Juliet who never backed down.
Romeo, 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 Romeo.
Tomorrow's getting harder, make no mistake.
Love can't even look, you gotta make your own break. It's my
April, I can't believe I'm engaged again. So much is happening in such a short time.
So much is happening. But whatever happens, I will be here for you. And you will be... fine.
It's my life. It's now or never. And I ain't gonna live forever. I just wanna live while I'm alive.
I'm
Oh, shit.
It's my life.
And Juliet, it is playing at the Civic Theatre from the 9th of April. Go and check it out. Kristen, welcome back. Filling in for Emma.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Great to have you here. And wasn't that a great night the other night?
It was so amazing. And just we got to stand on the stage and we got to see all the posters that were up. And I just thought, if I had any talent at all, I would leave my life and run off to the theater.
But wasn't it cool to stand on the Civic stage looking out to see what the cast see in that space? It was a really cool way of doing a launch. Great music, great entertainment, fabulous Kiwi cast. So, yeah, going to be very excited. In Wellington, Christchurch, you get a taste of it as well, I think, in May and June. So go and check it out. We'll play a few songs a little later on. But, yeah, it's a goodie. And it's great music. You'll know every song and not realise that the same person wrote so much music for so many different artists.
Right.
There's Katy Perry, there's Britney Spears.
Backstreet Boys.
It's fascinating.
You know what, I just want to say really quickly, they were talking to some of the cast and talking about the costumes, and they said that they had sourced the costumes from the op shops, and so they took that and then created these amazing magical costumes, mixing like wedding dresses, prom dresses, you know, denim jackets, these, you know, pantaloons, and it was just nothing short of super inspiring.
And because usually with a lot of these big shows now, I did Jersey Boys last year, and you can kind of get it from Aussie. It arrives in a container ship, and you've got your set, your costumes, and then you just tweak. Because Anne Juliet's so new, no one's finished yet. So those that have opened it haven't stopped yet to put it in that hireable situation. So they're having to create everything from scratch.
It was amazing. So gorgeous.
Very, very cool. Also headed up to Oree this week and saw Tootsie, which is a brand new Zealand premiere of the old classic 80s film. So well done, Centre Stage, kicking their year off with something, you know, really different. It's always an interesting gamble doing a premiere, and they did a great job.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, well done.
And Emma's been busy down the South Island with a musical theatre AGM this weekend down in Oamaru, and she caught up with James. Hi, James, our fabulous listener in the South who always comments on shirts and people, what people are wearing. So tonight's guests are dressed a little bit too similar, you'll have to wait till tomorrow to see the photo. That's a big welcome to Richard and Philippa from Dolphin Theatre. Welcome, team.
Hi.
Thank you for having us.
You have to wait for the photo for that to even make sense. But great to have you here. And Philippa, you're directing this show to kick off a busy Dolphin year. Dolphin are fabulous supporters of us, and they do so much throughout the year. So no pressure, you're up first. Tell us about the show.
Okay, so Every Brilliant Thing is kicking off the 2026 season at the Dolphin. We are a studio show, which means they are smaller shows and shorter runs, so, you know, fewer tickets available.
Yes.
But nice, it does plug. Mean that we get to do slightly more experimental things, and I think Every Brilliant Thing is a really good example of that. So if you've not heard anything about this play ever before, what you need to know is it's a one-person play. So it's carried by one performer for about an hour and 15, I would say. And it's the story of a person who's had some experience with poor mental health in their family. So they've had a mother who's really, really struggled, and at a very young age they try to support their mum. At the age of 7, they try to support their mum by creating a list of every brilliant thing that they can think of to kind of say, look, mum, look at all of these things that are great.
Oh,
but, you know,
cool.
At 7 years old, they're like roller coasters, ice cream, The Simpsons, things like that. And so it's maybe not necessarily the best way of connecting with mum. But this list then kind of comes in and out of their life. You follow this person as they become a teenager, as they become a university student, as they meet their first partner, and the list comes in and out of their life at different points. It gives them strength. There's time. It's a way that they connect with other people. But then the other thing to know about this play is that it is a performance between the main performer and the audience. It is a really fascinatingly crafted script, because firstly, the list is mostly delivered by the audience. So the audience arrive at the play, the performer greets people, chats with them. It's a very informal start to the play, and they are given bits of the list, so they're given items to read out, and then there will be points at which audience members become characters in the play as well.
Physically coming up on stage, or is it sort of in the safety of their seats?
A mix.
Okay.
Yeah.
Intriguing.
Yeah.
I'm going to go and check where I'm sitting now.
Yeah. So that obviously creates a different level to the experience. So I think that was the first thing that really, really grabbed me about this script, was I love plays that couldn't be anything other than a play. So plays where you need to be in that room, in that theatre, in that experience, at that moment, to have that experience. I think you can see recordings of this play. It's not a new play. It's about 10 years old. It was created by a comedian called Johnny Donohoe alongside a playwright called Duncan McMillan. It's played in the West End. It's actually currently on Broadway in New York.
Wow.
You know, it's a very it's becoming quite an established play, but it's unlike anything I've ever read before.
Wow, that's fantastic. You did such a fantastic job, Philippa, of describing that. So many people come on the show and they go, well, I don't want to give her this way, I don't, and we actually don't learn enough. But that, for me, is a selling point, is how you've described it. It feels like a very different show for Dolphin too, which is exciting.
Yeah, that was probably the first thing that was said to me when the script was given. It was kind of like, we want to do this, we're not sure if it's right for our audience. We haven't made firm decisions yet, and obviously then we talked it through and decided it was Dolphin luckily decided it was something that they were willing to try. And I think that's one of the great things that I'm finding about working with Dolphin, is actually they really do want to provide theatrical experiences for lots of different kinds of audiences, and I think they just, like, this year they've got such a fantastically varied season,
and that's good, because that's catering for everybody.
But I think occasionally sometimes the thing that is missing from community theatre are those more unusual, more experimental, maybe slightly riskier things, and I do totally understand, you know, why that can be a real risk to take. But this feels, despite the fact that it is, you know, if you come along and see this play, you will be part of an audience that is engaged with it, and you're part of an audience that is helping to make the play happen and come alive. Now, that might not necessarily mean that you individually will be, you know, reading something aloud, or you will be on stage helping, but because including audience has been part of our rehearsal process, we have found that audience members say, even when they're not actually specifically called upon to do something, when another audience member is, they feel like the whole audience is kind of part of that.
Yeah.
And the audience interaction, when you read the script, and especially when you read it again and again through rehearsal, you see how carefully crafted it is. And the audience takes on small roles, but they have been very carefully crafted, so nobody is being asked to come on stage and kind of create a whole character from nothing. It's very guided. If you are an audience member who does come along to this and does end up participating and coming on stage, you will be guided as to what to do. You'll be given, you'll be so supported. It's very, very carefully done. And I think some people get concerned about
It's not a stand-up comedy where you're about to get up and get roasted.
Absolutely.
I think that's a key part of it as well, is that, a lot of people that shy away from, they want to tend to sit at the back if they hear that there's audience participation. Mm. It's because, you know, if you get involved, the assumption is that, I'm going to be made the butt of a joke somehow. But there's nothing really like that in this play, it's all, and like you said, we've been doing audience interaction as part of our rehearsals, and so it's like, and getting people in that aren't at all familiar with the script, and when doing those interactions and being like, be very honest, did you feel supported? Is there any time where you felt left out, anything like that? And you know, working those bits so that they're as comfortable for the person.
And we've made changes as well to how we've approached those moments in light of when we've had an audience member come in and we've worked with it and been like, oh, actually, it feels like maybe this audience member is going to misinterpret this.
Right,
they're going to be stood not knowing what they're doing for too long here. So we've really, really crafted these moments. And right from casting, we knew that it was going to be absolutely crucial to get performers who could make a really warm connection with the audience right from the beginning, and who could the audience could feel very comfortable with and could trust that they are there to support them, and they're not there to be kind of like, oh, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to make fun of you, I'm going to make a big joke or anything.
So, Richard, it's all on you as the solo performer. What's it like? This is a different... We've had you on the show before with different shows. This feels very different to what you've done before.
Totally. And should point out one of two performers. So there's six shows total, alternating nights. So I'm sharing the role with Jess Karamjeet, who's a stand-up comedian, performer, musician, everything. And it's very interesting coming into this with like two sort of sets of skills to come into it, because there is like a little bit of piano playing involved, and I'm having to learn how to play the piano for it. But anyway, it is very different doing it, and there are moments, especially like when we had the first read through, where you turn the page and there's just an entirety of you speaking, and the reality hits you of like, this is a lot. Not even like the memorization side of it, just the fact that it's like, this is a long time to be speaking and to hold attention from people. But yeah, it's been a really fun process, and I think what sort of interested me about it as well is that it's something that when I first read the script for the audition, that there was a part of me that was like, I don't know if I can do this. Which is like, there's a lot of plays that come around, you're like, yeah, I could see myself playing this character. And there are certain things where I'm like, yeah, I know how I'd deliver that, yada, yada. But like, relying so heavily on like the energy of the room and like the I mean, like, it is in a way similar to stand up, and we just sort of said it's not, but like, it was written by a stand up comedian and a playwright, so it does sort of fuse those worlds, and it uses Johnny Donahue's sort of knowledge of working a crowd, working a room, things like that. And yeah, the way the script is written is really interesting as well, that it's like, oh, if they say this as well, you can add this part.
Right.
Where, so, because there's certain bits where, like, there are a couple of bits where it's like, just say this. And then there are some where it's like, you have no idea what they're going to say. And so you just have to be able to respond to that. And that's sort of the part that is like uncharted waters that's quite interesting.
Yeah, it means that every night, every single one of these six shows that we do are going to be completely unique, because there'll be different audience members telling the story alongside the performer. So not only is it that we have these two incredible performers taking three shows each, but in each of those, you don't know exactly what's going to happen.
Well, I also think as well, like, even if we had the exact same crowd with the exact same level of intoxication, at the same time of day, everything, the show would still feel so different. And that's one of the cool things about how this script is written and doing rehearsals, because the way we've been doing rehearsals is that Jess and I will sort of have one each during the week, and then we come together for one on Sunday. So we try something out by ourselves, and then we show each other and we can work on it. There are heaps of bits that are like just such different interpretations of the same words. And, you know, some are like, so there are certain things that Jess will do that I'm like, well, that's great, but I couldn't pull that off. So like, I have to do it a different way. And there are certain bits as well that I'm like, oh yeah, I'm stealing that. Like, it is just really interesting that it's like, it is the same words, but just how like the slightly different attitude can completely change things. And then when you're adding in this other element of like unpredictability.
What's your role, Philippa, from a director's point of view with the unpredictability bit? Mm-hmm. Like, is your job to make sure you've tested as many possible ways that this could go? Or is there a little bit of, I don't want to over rehearse it because I want it to be fresh on the night?
Mm. Yeah.
Or somewhere in the middle, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah, I think just like Richard was saying that when he got the script, he's like, I don't know if I could do this. I definitely, as a director, had a similar feeling of like, how do you rehearse a play where there are significant scenes that you can't rehearse? Really, you can't. You don't know how they're going to play until you get somebody in the room. So, the way I think my job for this is to make sure that we know the emotional journey of the play, and we know the moments there are more kind of. Performer led, because there are some beautiful, beautiful monologues in this play, that those are very, very, you know, confident and crafted, and they are, like, they're stunning. And bringing in audience has been our way of saying, you know, here are some people who have not been, you know, reading the script on, you know, on and on and on for weeks now, and we'll bring a really fresh perspective. So I've been building in opportunities for Richard and Jess to perform in front of people who will challenge them. But we have also come in with this ethos that the audience aren't gonna be there to try and trip you up. Like, the audience are going to want to have a great show, and so we want to think of the different ways that can be interpreted and the different ways the audience might come at it, but also to know that the vast majority of interactions are going to be supportive, but they might be surprising. So I think, yeah, it's been building a rehearsal schedule that's had enough space to really build in that audience interaction element. I was very, very lucky that I actually have a mutual friend with Johnny Donahoe, who was one of the writers of the play, which I didn't realise before I actually started doing this.
Wow.
So I was able to have a conversation with, you know, the original performer, original writer of the show, and get some insights. And his really big thing was, you know, you have these elements of unpredictability, and the more that you can really craft the parts, like the monologues and that kind of thing, and then just be ready to go with the audience in this kind of spirit of generosity, but the more you have everything else down, the more confident you are, then the more you can be free to play with the more kind of unpredictable elements. But yeah, it is strange directing a play that will not be completed until it is actually in front of an audience, which I suppose in many ways that is just plays, but in, you know, there's things that the performers are going to be faced with, but I think they're ready. I think they're getting more and more, like, every time we get new audience in, they get more and more playful, they get more and more confident, and just more and more magical and unpredictable things are happening.
Brilliant. All right, let's take a short music break, and then we'll find out a little bit more about your own arts journey that led up to this experience. Our good friends Borderline are back with another track, and they've brought out their official video to Watching It Burn. Man, they're doing some great things, releasing tracks. We're seeing them headlining concerts. They're on 7 days, I think, this week. It's so good to see how fast they're all growing. Here it is, Watching It Burn.
An actor, never say what I'm thinking, always so dramatic when you say that you're leaving. You slam the door, don't know what for. I'm a lot, but you're a lot, that says a lot. Ooh, I'm wondering how
me a traitor for putting my heart on too easy to cut this like a razor paper. Is it the house where we placed it? All I know now is I'm sleeping on the pavement. Ooh, I'm wondering how you haven't worked it out. You should know by now. I hate to
Borderline watching it burn. So funny, Kristen, watching these guys and so many that, that we've taught over the years as drama teachers and had them in our shows, and then you see them now doing these fabulous international things. It's so cool. But you watch these videos and you're like, wow, you're all grown up.
It's so nice because, and so I grew up in California and we didn't get a lot of Australian or New Zealand actors. If they did, we got them on the soap operas. So we knew Rick Springfield and, you know, some of them that way, Tristan Rogers. Yet it's so great that these younger people or artists are now being able to go and do international so that more people who just don't watch soap operas can really benefit from perspective from over here, which is a very beautiful perspective. Living on this side of the world for as long as we have, it definitely has changed my life for the better.
I think, too, the amount of international acts that come here now and go, we want to see up-and-coming New Zealand headline us. You know, we're not bringing somebody with us. We want to use local. And who is it that's only just scratching the surface and now the ones getting these gigs? It's great.
It is so amazing. I can't remember now. It has just left me because I've seen quite a few artists here. And when a New Zealand and Australian act open for a big international act, it just makes me feel so proud to be here because they are right up there with that energy and that talent, and I'm just so grateful. I can't remember who it is, but hopefully I'll remember, and maybe we can play one of their tunes next time.
Brilliant. All right, back to our guests. So, Richard, take us back. When did the arts first kick off for you? Are you going to continue? Every time Kristen's here, we have guests that started with the church nativity play, you know, and they played someone in that. Are you going to continue that reign of thought?
Well, sorry to break your...
Okay, well, that's the end of Richard, so over to you for a bit. All right, so Richard, tell us.
I guess, all the drama and everything in high school, and then... Yeah, it was really coming out of high school. I didn't really have any plans, and I, like, quarter to midnight on the day that the applications shut, I applied for Hagley Theatre Company.
Okay.
Because a friend of my sister's had gone there and recommended it as a place to go. And so, yeah, that was like, cool, I've got this. And then I had an audition for it. And then, like, that week, and then the next Monday I started. And so that was, like, really the sort of first, you know, like, full-time arts taking over. And it was interesting because it's like a... They always described it as, like, this is a place where you come to kind of check your ego a little bit. And because it's the person from every high school in Christchurch who got all the lead roles kind of thing. And now you're coming in and it's like, well, you know, there's only one or two lead roles. So everyone's competing for it. But whereas like in my high school, I was not that kid. But then kind of by the end of Hagley, I was. But but then I went to broadcasting school after that. Got more into the like other side of the arts, so and then I've been worked in newsrooms worked at TVNZ for a long time, got my redundant, and then was like, well, let's see if my original dream of acting is still has any juice left in it. So, yeah, heard about auditions for Clue at the Dolphin, and then, yeah, been doing Dolphin stuff sort of pretty regularly ever since. This is my fourth show appearing in, and I also directed one of the one acts from London Suite last year.
Fantastic.
Oh, so dreams really do come true.
Yes.
I'm gonna do my vision board later tonight.
Yeah.
Is this your first time doing kind of an immersive piece?
Yeah, I mean, I have a small amount of stand-up experience, which sort of in 2016-17 I did like the Raw circuit in Auckland and got through to the semi-finals, and then I just sort of after that I lost the passion for it. It's like, it is very much something that you like have to keep at, the skill of like writing and stay passionate. And I think especially that it's like, as a white man, I was like, what is unique about my voice? And then I eventually decided nothing, and I couldn't figure out like my hook or my angle that would make me stand out. And I think that was the wall that I hit, and that I just never bothered to try and push past. So it is good to like the, you know, having that stuff of reacting very much based on what a crowd is doing, and like those small moments of unpredictability. But yeah, in terms of like this, it's interesting as well that like the first show I did at Dolphin had a cast of like 11. Then I was in Proof, which had a cast of 4, and then Adam Room, which had a cast of 3. And now this is a cast of 1/10/2.
You're kind of screwed from here, buddy. Like, this is it.
Well, if I
new theatre group.
If I count this as the double cast as a cast of 2, I just have one more.
Brilliant. And Philippa, what about you? When did it all start? And was it always sort of the directing side, or have you had a journey on stage like Richard?
So I did start in Nativities, lead angel.
Every week Mary, you're here. Mary.
Narrator. I really loved all of that stuff when I was at school, and then I gave myself way too much to do from kind of university onwards, and had no time for the things that I really enjoyed. Don't do that, but you make space for those things in your life, and I have in the last 5 years. I came back to it. I started by getting back into the acting side of it. I was encouraged into that by my partner, who's been doing Auckland Community Theatre for a really, really long time. And my first show was, amazingly, I got cast as a lead in an Agatha Christie at Howick Little Theatre back in 2020. And it was like Agatha Christie's Hamlet. Like, this one lead role had like 50% of the lines. And it was such a massive gamble. They cast me and I hadn't done anything for like 10 years. And I was so terrified because everyone else had so much more experience than me, that I had kind of learned pretty much the script by the time we started rehearsals, because I was so, so scared. But I did that, and it was just really, really good fun. I don't think I necessarily impressed anybody massively.
But it got you back on stage.
It did get me back on stage. And I'm trying to remember how I got into... Oh, I got into directing completely accidentally. I was stage managing a production of Importance of Being Earnest at the start of 2021, and the director had to leave the project about 2 weeks out from opening, and so I kind of covered one rehearsal after they left, to just be like, oh, I'll stand in while we find somebody. And then I ended up just directing it until we opened, and really, really enjoyed that. And so I think it's probably directing has been the thing I've been doing most. I was in Shoreside's Romeo and Juliet earlier this year as Lady Capulet, and I really enjoy acting, but I find it a lot harder than directing, because it's like, well, I can't see myself. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know if anything I don't know if anything I'm doing looks right, feels right. Like, it's, I find it so strange. But directing, I really love, because I love having the view of the whole story. So you're kind of, you know, you're the advocate for the audience, of like, how is this story coming across? How is it being told? What are we emphasizing? And I do also really love the aspect of kind of supporting actors to, you know, to give the best performance. So I do that. I also do some intimacy, advising around, Auckland Community Theatre as well, which I also really love because it's very similar to directing. It's it's very technical. It's kind of try and explain it to people who don't know that much about it.
I describe
like choreography.
Well, that's exactly what I said to someone today. I asked about it, and I said, imagine choreography of an intimate moment. And it's very routine and it's very repetitive and keep it safe.
The first time Philip and I worked together as was the intimacy coordinator on Proof. And fantastic, couldn't speak higher of the experience of working with Philip on that. So it was
this, however.
No, it's been wonderful.
I love that because I do, I love the story side of things. I love the problem solving, but I do really love the people. And when you're doing things like directing, intimacy advising, even stage managing, you get to really be that kind of foundation on which other people can build these fantastic things, is the hope. And I have been incredibly lucky in every brilliant thing in that, Richard and Jess have come with so many skills already, and so many things that they are way advanced. You know, they've got way more experience acting than I do, way more experience at stand-up comedy than I do. So it's
piano.
Oh my gosh. Musically, I'd say maybe not more experienced than me at piano.
No, I'm
Jess,
definitely not.
Jess, definitely.
So what are you hoping audiences will take away from the show?
I really hope that connection is one of the key things that resonates with people. Because when you're... There is the story of the play, but also the experience of the play is about... being generous enough to be vulnerable and to engage with other people, and that when you do that, scary but magical things can happen. So from the story, I would really like people to take away the feeling of, you know, when you do choose to engage with people, when you choose to talk to people, to be vulnerable, good things happen, because that's an experience that the narrator, the performer has again and again in this story, is they, when they do actually choose to engage, great things happen. But also with the play itself, I think when you see audience members taking that leap to be like, oh, okay, I'm just going to do it. I'm gonna get involved. I'm gonna be a little bit vulnerable, but I'm gonna be trusting, then you get the most incredible experience and the most incredible performance. So I think it's something that really, this play is all about connection, vulnerability, and
nice. Richard, biggest thing you're looking forward to? If we talk to you after the show, what will it be? You know, what's that moment you're really looking forward to?
There is one specific part in the play, which is like, I basically just get given something and I have to riff on that, which I always love doing in rehearsals because, I won't spoil it, but there's like, you just getting handed something every night and having to build a conversation around it. But it is that unpredictability, and like, it has been just so much fun in rehearsal anytime we have fresh people in. But also worth mentioning as well, if you know the Dolphin Theatre, this is actually going to be staged in the foyer, because the play is written to be performed in the round. So, like, to have you in the middle. We're not doing it quite in the round, but it's, like, going to be surrounded on three sides.
Oh, that's cool.
So you're a little bit different. So it does mean that that seats are limited as well, so get in quick. But they... but also, and the other thing as well, is that, like, just really make it clear that, like, I know there are going to be people scared to come along because of the audience interaction element, but it is like Philip mentioned earlier, there's the bit before the play where Jess or myself will be handing out the things that need to be read during the course of the play, and I hope this isn't too like revealing how the sausage is made, but I've seen Daniel Radcliffe talking about this on Colbert, that this is what he's doing, but like that there is a half hour period where I am talking to the room and handing these things out. I am also getting an idea of who's going to be comfortable doing this.
Yeah,
like, the point isn't to drag anyone so far out of their comfort zone. And there is also, like, you know, I guess the assumption that if you're sitting way at the back and your body language is, like, super... That is, I'm not going to...
You want them just to enjoy their night.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so... Like, if you are someone that, like, this play sounds interesting, but you're really scared of being picked on, like, it's not that kind of thing at all.
That's cool. That's awesome. Now, if Emma was here, she would ask a very important question, because I've been looking at the show dates for your show, and there's no Tuesday treats.
No.
You know, that might push Emma over the edge here. No Tuesday treats. We only come on a Tuesday. Got to have our treats.
Yeah, well...
So the treat has been in the show?
The treat is being, you know, like a nice evening of theatre. And it is, yeah, it's part of the thing of being a studio show. Yeah. Tickets are cheaper as well.
It is worth mentioning that it is different to Dolphin's main stage shows, which is why it's not kind of necessarily on all the same kind of posters as those things. They are much shorter runs. We wouldn't actually be having a Wednesday show if it weren't for the fact that because we have two performers, we need six shows rather than five so that we, you know, can divide
equally. Didn't have to toss a coin.
So they are shorter runs, and they are kind of like blink and you'll miss them. I think we are this time in 2 weeks, it will all be done. So if it sounds interesting,
go and support. Where can people go to get tickets and all that important stuff?
It's on the Dolphin website, which I believe is
dolphintheatre.co.nz.
Dolphintheatre.org.nz.
Sorry, bleep that.
But I reckon if you just chucked it into Google, Dolphin Theatre on a hunger, you would find it. And yeah, we do have slightly limited seats because it's in the foyer and not in the theatre. There are about 50 seats per night.
Okay.
So get in quick, team.
Head to dolphintheatre.org.nz. Thank you so much for coming in. This is really exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm coming along. It's your show, Richard, that I'm coming to. No pressure, buddy.
Hope you're ready to get involved.
Well, I might be that person in the back row with my arms folded, but we'll see. But all the best, and thank you. You've really talked so well about your show tonight, so I congratulate you for that, because that's often part of the challenge when something's a little bit different.
How much do you give away? A lot.
Yeah,
that's passionate about this play.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Now, music break now, but Kristen, a little bit different to normal because it's been a bit of an internet sensation. It's an old clip, but it's doing the rounds again, and I just have to play it. Were you a fan of the original 1968 movie Oliver?
You know I was.
And the beautiful Shani Wallace, who played Nancy, rocked on up to the auditions of Britain's Got Talent, and at 92 years of age, sang that song again. This is, of course, a YouTube clip, so I've clipped the bit at the beginning, but you will hear the judges speak a little bit. But it's just so special, so let's take a listen.
She's singing the song from the movie.
As long as he needs me. Oh, my God.
As long as he needs me. Oh, yes. He does need me. In spite of what you see, I'm sure that he needs me. Who else would love him still? When they've
been still got it.
He knows I always will, as long as he needs me. So much when he is gone, but when he's near me, I don't let on.
She's wonderful.
He doesn't say the things he should. He acts the way he thinks he should, but all the same, I'll play this game his way.
fantastic. The original Nancy, Shani Wallace from the 1968 movie at 92, back on the stage in London singing that song again. And our next guest has just confessed she has played in Oliver, and I've played in Oliver. I think it's one of those sort of rite of passages as in early theatre days. A big welcome to the studio now, Helen Ellis, who's here to chat about her latest book, Being a Distant Grandchild. But I see there's been a distant few other books in the series. Welcome, Helen. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us, first of all, before we even talk about the books, tell us about you. Who is Helen? What's been your journey and story that led up to you thinking that you'd write some books?
Well, I guess the story with when it comes to family separated by geography, it comes back to my personal situation. So my husband and I, it's our blended family. We have two kids each, and we've been married for over 30 years, but my husband is older than me. So when I married, I had much older kids who we got married. All the kids were 3, 4, and 19 and 20. So we were a pretty odd-looking family. But as a what happened from there was that the oldest left home very early in the piece, went to England, got married, had kids, and now they're 23 and 26. And then my stepdaughter got married and married a Scotsman, and they had two kids. And then my kids decided to go overseas. So the long the short of it was that six of our seven grandchildren and four of our three kids live 16 to 30 hours away. And we've been doing distance families for a long time, longer than most people and longer than most grandmothers. Most times, right. You know, when the first child arrives, you might be in your 60s, 70s, or whatever. I started at 40.
Wow.
So, and then on top of that, I did went back as a mature student to university, decided to do a Bachelor of Arts and prove that I could do this sort of thing. And one of the last papers that I did was about how to do a research proposal. Mm-hmm. And so my professor said to me, okay, Helen, if you were to do your master's, what would you do it on? Well, I'd majored in social anthropology. I was really interested in people and societies, and I'd been in the travel industry. And I thought, well, you know, distance grandparenthood, I know about that. I've been doing it for a long time. And I found, at part of that process, I had to do research on what was out there. There was just about nothing. Mm. And when you consider that roughly 20% of people born in New Zealand now live overseas, that's a huge percentage of families living in another time zone. So that led to me realizing there was next to nothing out there in the whole world, not just New Zealand, but the whole world, and decided that the world needed a body of information, a body of research. Mm. And that led me to deciding to do my master's to get some letters after my name so I wasn't the granny from New Zealand. And then I realised that the world needed a body of knowledge, and they needed it about each generation. So that's why I have written a book about how it is for each generation to help generate empathy between generations.
And hasn't technology played such a part in the change? I mean, I remember being a young child and my older brother got a job in Mauke, which is a little island off Rarotonga. And I can remember my mum just as this 18-year-old left, and all we could get was telegrams. Mm-hmm. So you would occasionally, maybe 2 or 3 months, go by and the telegram would be delivered, which was, I'm still alive, stop, everything's good, stop, met a woman, stop, might be having a baby, stop. That was the sort of message that we would get. Thanks, Michael. Yes. Nowadays, my daughter's overseas. Mm-hmm. My other one's a long-haul flight attendant. And FaceTime. I mean, they just, you know, at the most crazy hours, day and night, but you just love it. And you're just talking to them, and it's like they're just in the bedroom in the other room. It's so changed, hasn't it?
It absolutely has. But the emotions are still.
Oh, yeah, you still miss them.
Yes,
yeah.
When they decide to go and, you know, you've still got to work through that grief and that whole feeling.
And it's learning how much to support them, not support them, let them stand on their own 2 feet. But you also are desperate to go and visit, you know. So how do you talk about sort of finding that balance?
Yes. Well, I think it sort of works out because, you know, it can be finance and annual leave and what's happening at their end. And so I find that generally works out. You know, people get their rhythm about how they're going to do this. And you soon realize that some people can go and stay 2 or 3 months with their kids. We don't. 10 days, 2 weeks, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we know that they've got to get on with their lives, so you're better to have a concentrated time where they can take some time off. Because, for example, two of our kids live in America. They have very little annual leave. Mm. You know, it's a tricky place. So
talk through your different books, because they're obviously aimed at different people in this family relationship, aren't they?
Yes and no.
Yes and no? Okay, talk us through it.
The yes is that each book is, the first one was being a distance grandparent, so that's about us back home. How is it for them? And then the second one was how being a distant son or daughter. So that's the expats, the migrants, our kids who go away. And then my latest one is being a distant grandchild. So that child who's only known, you know, all or some of their grandparents living in another country. Now, yes, each book is for each generation because it gives them a feeling that they're not alone. And it gives them many examples of similar stories to theirs. And then they start to realize, yeah, you know, I'm not by myself. And this is other ways that I could do things. But the subtitle of every book is A Book for All Generations. Because what I learned in my research was that there is a lot that goes unsaid between the generations. So it doesn't matter how much FaceTime you've got. There's stuff that just doesn't get said. And, you know, the ones who are away have a feeling of guilt. Their strongest emotion is the guilt of the left-behind family. But the ones at home, they hardly know that. So I decided I wanted to be the one to fill those voids. So I really encourage each generation to read the other generation's books so they understand how it is for the other.
That's a good idea. What's been the feedback?
Oh, lots of moments and tears and just the latest book. Honestly, I would, interview these grandchildren and I would write a chapter about our talk, and then I would get an email when I sent them a draft, and I'd, you know, open my emails in the morning and, oh dear, you know, it's tears, and they go, oh, it really struck me about this and something I hadn't heard or thought about. But all the time, I try and give a really positive message that just because you're geographically apart, it doesn't need to be World War II. Families can still thrive, and I've seen so many examples of where it works. You do your best job, you're intentional about how you do it. And I know families where there's maybe three children, and the one that the parents have the closest relationship is the one who's the furthest away.
Interesting. Is there an element of, I think of my own girls, is that an element of, because they're away, when you do make time to talk, you want a more deep and meaningful conversation, where the one in the house, it's easy to say, how's your day, cool, good, and just move off? Like, what triggers that?
I think it's very much up to the proactiveness of the one who is away. Because when there are families involved, or families live overseas, they're the gatekeeper. Because, you know, they're busy, children, all that sort of thing. So when you've got there's grandchildren in the picture, generally I find the grandparents back home are pretty keen, pretty proactive. If they say, yeah, we'll talk to you at 8 o'clock in the morning, they're up, they're ready, they're all ready to go, you know. But they can be stymied in their actions if, you know, the daughter-in-law is not so keen, or, you know, the circumstances aren't so great at the other end, and they don't like granny, or there's some family complications. So I think when the away generation is really super proactive as best as they can in their circumstances to keep communication up, to make them feel welcome, you know, to travel home if they can, then yes, they can be really successful. You know, it can work, yeah.
Wow. So how do you make these books? You just mentioned you did some interviews.
Yes.
How do you piece this book together?
Well, I could say it's like a massive jigsaw with lots of little bits. So the grandparent book was the basis of it, the framework of it was my thesis that I did for my master's. But obviously you have to take all the gobbledygook out and make it a mainstream book. So I used that and added a lot of more everyday things that, you know, academics don't want to read. And then I got to the son and daughter, and by then I had a sort of formula, that a pattern of chapters, and I just tweaked them, you know, with different generations for the next one, trying to explain, you know, introduce all the issues that migrants and expats deal with, which most of us don't think about at home, you know, whether it's language and culture, and every time they open their mouth, they, you know, they've, everybody asks, where are you from, and all those sorts of issues. So I wanted to write about that and how that relates to families back home. So the format of the first two books is fairly similar. When I got to the grandchild book, I got, I don't know how I'm going to do this one. And so I pondered on that for quite a long time, and I ended up by digging out every little bit of academic research that there was, and there's like nearly zero. I can give you an interesting statistic. I found one academic who quoted how little there is written ever officially about grandchildhood. And she did a survey of titles and topics of academic literature about families separated by geography. And her statistic is that there were 747 mentions of grandparenthood and 18 of grandchildhood.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're all grandchildren. How come there isn't more research? I found that staggering. So when I saw and started to get a grip of the fact that hardly anyone anywhere in the world is researching that topic, I thought, well, it's free range.
Let's
you
do
can
it.
Do what you want. So I ended up by interviewing a bunch of distance grandchildren of all different ages, but they were adults all around the world, different scenarios, different situations, like the children of missionary parents who've lived everywhere in far-flung crazy places, to, you know, somebody who moved from Lancashire here to New Zealand and had lived in like a Coronation Street setting and came here. So all different, you know, situations. And then I started looking for commonalities to their experiences, so I could, you know, could write that. So that's how it ended up by happening.
Fantastic. Yeah. All right, we'll take a short music break, then I'm going to ask you your top tips for each of those categories. Now, as I said at the top of the show, Kristen and I visited Anne Juliet's little preview this week. This is my favourite song from the show, and we heard it this week. It's going to be amazing. That's the way it is.
I can read your mind, and I know your story. I see what you're going through. Yeah, it's an uphill climb, and I'm feeling sorry, but I know it will come to you. So don't surrender, 'cause you can win in this thing called love. When you want it the most, there's no easy way out. When you're ready to go, lifting up, don't give up on your faith. Love comes to those who believe it, and that's the way it is. So when you question me for a simple answer, I don't know what to say. But it's plain to see, if you stick together, you're gonna find your way. So don't surrender, 'cause you can win in this thing called it, and that's the way it is.
the way it is. Just love that song. And I think it was Afi Mai who sang it the other night for us. Just stunning. So, back chatting with our fabulous author, Helen Ellis. Tell us, Helen, what are some of your top tips for being a distance grandchild?
Grandchild, well, I really recommend that grandchildren, and they have to be encouraged by their parents, have a way of connecting with their grandparents that's on a one-on-one basis.
Mm.
I can tell you, if you're a distance grandchild, doesn't matter how old you are, that being able to have a one-on-one conversation or video call or going out to a coffee shop or whatever when you happen to be visiting, that's all their Christmases at once.
Yeah.
And I relate it back to when I've been a regular grandmother here in New Zealand, and for two girls, and I would pick my granddaughters up from school or kundi or whatever. And you think about, you're sitting in the car, you're not looking at each other, and you're driving along, and we'd have great conversations. And those are where relationships are built. So that would be a really important thing. You know, once in 6 weeks, even if it's a couple of months, you contact them, you initiate it, you set it up. Honestly, they will be so happy for weeks and weeks. And the other two things is, say thank you. One of the big complaints I get over and over again from distance grandparents is, nobody says thank you for the present. Or the card. So just do those old fashioned things, and make your bed when you come and stay, and you will be, you know, fantastic as far as you can see.
those are such great tips. I think the thank you one is the one I hear from both my mother and my mother-in-law about their grandkids, not to get anybody in trouble, but it's they just really appreciate that because they grew up with that, and they just want to know that somebody values the thought that they put into it.
Yes.
Ah, such great tips. You're so wise.
What's been the most surprising, I guess, thing that you've learned during the journey of writing these books?
I think I was really surprised when it came to the grandchild book, just how little there was out there. I just couldn't believe it. I thought, you can't be the only voice in the whole of the world, Helen. This is crazy, you know? And then I was really surprised at how the grandchildren I spoke with reacted in the way of, I would, you know, give them a few prompt questions, and they'd go, you could see their eyes on the video call go, nobody has ever asked me how it was being separated from my grandparents, because they never had a choice, you know, they just lived wherever. And they would go, I've never been asked that. Nobody's ever asked how it felt. And, you know, sometimes there were tears, not upset, but just, I've never thought about that. Nobody's ever been interested. So that really got to me, because I realized that these kids had their lives set out and planned, and their parents had decided we're going on an adventure, or I'm going to marry this person from another country, or whatever, however it ended up, but they never had an option. So that you know, that really got me. And I think overall, I just am so, I'm just in awe of everybody who makes a damn good effort and has a longitudinal attitude about it all. And I always feel for the brand first-time grandmother who's got this grandchild arriving on the other side of the world, and they're so concerned about, will I have a relationship with this child? And I can understand why they feel like that, but I always say, look, I need you to know it's a long-term thing. You got to keep, you know, tapping away, one more call, one more this, one more little present, one more visit, one more, and absolutely, you keep doing it, and you will have a thriving relationship, just different from your grandchildren who will live down the road.
Yeah. You've self-published these books?
I have.
So what's that journey been like, putting out a series?
Oh, wow. What a huge learning curve, especially being a self-published author in New Zealand, because, you know, we don't have Amazon down the road that everybody thinks about. You know, if you talk, I mean, my books are available around the world. I'm working with different organizations and colleagues around the world. And the first thing they go is, oh, yeah, pick it up from Amazon. So, of course, here, you know, I had to print the books, and I have to, you know, find someone to distribute them, and I have to... It's just a huge thing being a New Zealand self-published author. So I've had some big learning curves, and spent a fair amount of money.
You've got to have that backing, don't you? But at least it gets the books out, because we've got such a limited number that get published.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's the key, I guess. Are you finding people have purchased the whole series now?
Yes, though the grandchild book's just been
just out.
Yes. But they get it. I'm trying to get the message about thinking about the other, because everybody gets just wrapped up about their world.
Mm.
But when they understand how it is for the other, you know, I say to grandparents, did you know that the strongest emotion your kids feel is the guilt of the left behind family? And they look at me, really? Really? So when they react like that, I think, I've got a message. I want to tell you it. Yeah.
So what's next?
Oh, good question. I'd like to have a little rest. I don't have any books in me. I think I've contributed to, you know, the self-publishing New Zealand world.
I think you need to do being a distance employer or employee. People now that work so remotely and actually hardly ever see their manager. There we go. There's your next one.
I was going to say pets.
Yeah.
Or I could see a children's book.
Yeah.
Out of one of those, like when you have your rest and get your space and your inspiration.
Yes.
Yeah, I like what you. Yeah,
because it is. You know, if you are managing a team that's around the world, you know, how do you look after them, support them, make sure they're okay, but also you know get the work done, etc.
Yes.
There's some huge learnings to be done in that employment space.
There's a lot of good people out there who write on that, and that I spend time with them. So, but the pet ones, because pets are huge, aren't they? Being the distance pet, there we go.
Brilliant. Where can people go to get your books and find out more about you and your journey?
Well, I have a website, Distance Families with a CE, distancefamilies.co.nz. The shop page will give you all the links, but basically you can buy them from any shop in New Zealand, but you'll need to ask them. But I'd really like to put a shout out for bookhub.co.nz, the initiative Booksellers Association. So if you want to know which independent bookstores in New Zealand actually have copies of these on their shelves, go to bookhub.co.nz and enter the title, being a distance, whatever, and you will see who's got them. And I just really want to support those bookstores, because, you know, not all of their stock is on sale and return. So when they buy stocks, you know,
they're taking
a gamble. So I would really like people to support Book Hub and support those booksellers who have invested in copies. So, and there's an ebook as well available through all the normal channels, and I did an audio book on the grandparent book.
Ah, cool.
Yes. So.
Did you record that yourself?
I did. I narrated it myself, and my my son, sorry, who lives in the States, is a broadcaster, and he did the introduction.
That's cool.
There we go.
Congratulations.
That is so cool. Yeah. Well, go and support Helen by picking up the book. As she said, from Book Hub's a good place to find out where it is, Being a Distance Grandchild, or check out the other books as well. Thank you so much, Helen. We'll let you have a rest, and then we'll see what you come back with in the future.
Thank you for having me.
It's brilliant. Thank you. Music break time, and Kristen was asked what song would she like tonight, and she said Touch a Touch a Touch a Touch Me.
From
Rocky Horror. If you don't know, we're not having a moment here. And we chose the Glee version. It's a little bit different, so enjoy. Of course, Rocky Horror just closed, I think, a week ago here at the Civic. Short season.
But heard amazing.
Lots of great things about it. You caught it?
I did.
Yeah?
I did, and I went to a 1 o'clock Sunday show, and I thought, it's going to be tame. Heck no. It was on fire. Not a lot of shenanigans like they would that you get at the movie, but everybody was dressed up. Everybody was dancing. The energy was so high. It was a glitzy, glamorous, incredible, incredible performance with the live band at the top, and it was larger than life.
That is awesome. All right, take it away, Glee.
I was feeling dummy. Couldn't win. I'd only ever kissed before. I felt there's no use getting into heavy sweating. It only leads to trouble and bad fretting. Now all I want to know is how to go. Blood and I want more. I'll
That was Kristen's choice from Rocky Horror. If Kristen's partner's listening, good luck tonight. All right, great to see Rocky Horror. And we've just got so many fantastic shows coming to Auckland at the moment. It's really cool. Sadly, I think some of it's due to what's happening around the world. They're actually picking safer countries to tour to. But hey, make the most of it, New Zealand, because we've had a bit of a gap for a few years. But to have the Civic so busy, Rocky Horror into Anne Juliet, we've got the Menopause the Musical, into Heathers, into Jesus Christ Superstar with Anne Juliet, the big one for us with the Kiwi Talent
and Murder
team.
On the Nile at Dolphin Theatre.
Yeah, everything's happening.
Everything is happening. Get out there.
Now we're going to chat to something that is coming up at the Basement Theatre a little bit later this month. Scourge. I'm going to keep mucking that up. Sean will be going, what is he saying? Living Nightmare. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Hello, everyone. Hello. How are we doing?
Look, at the start of the show, I talked about it, and I'm going to get that word wrong. I don't know what it is. Sometimes you just have those mental blocks.
Wow.
Tell us, what is the show all about?
It's kind of a little bit of a love letter to looking for jokes and things to giggle at in your everyday life.
Okay.
I'm avoiding saying the name correctly because I love the way you fumble it.
No, please. Please, it's your show. Promote it.
Buck Scourge, Living Nightmare.
Excellent.
It's a little bit about just kind of ripping in and having fun. And so it is a clown show. It's an interactive show. And so people will come and they'll see what I mean. And it's very much, I don't know where the show is going to go a lot of the time. And it's kind of by design, because I think, you know, a real strength of live theater is finding something that can only happen in that one room with these people. So it is a little special. It is a little silly. And that's what Buck Scourge is.
Is this feeling, is Kristen, like another, we've got a bit of interaction happening. It's a night of it tonight. Is there interaction in this one, Sean, with the audience?
There is interaction, but it's not, don't worry, it's not too overbearing. You can tell me to back off if you don't like it. it's all very easy, don't worry.
So how did you create this masterpiece?
Well, when I came back from French clown school, if you believe that, there was all these skills that I'd been working on, and I really wanted to keep these good vibes going. So I settled down with a buddy of mine who was a DJ, and we kind of made bits, and he played the music, and then I kept trying to be funny, and we kind of got the ball rolling from there. And so this is a collection of little characters that I've put together in a longer show.
You mentioned sort of, you know, recognizing, I guess, things from our life. How much are we going to recognize ourselves inside your show?
Oh, wow. maybe in an abstract way.
Okay.
You might notice impulses or ideas. There's a character in there that loves to take things, and so runs into the crowd and tries and takes things. So maybe you might, some of you who are... I want to pinch things, might see that.
All right, putting my phone in my pocket. Thanks for the heads up. Tell us a little bit about your own journey in the arts. You mentioned the clown school. What sort of first kicked off your passion for the arts? Take us back.
Oh, wow. Well, I first went to perform on a stage in a little town called Lee, up near Warkworth, which is where I grew up. Now, we didn't have a theater up there. We had pubs and bars with stages. So I was 16, I think, and I was doing this ensemble piece. It was all a bunch of us young guys wearing leather jackets, pretending to fight on stage. And the patrons all had long days, and they were all drinking. And so they were shouting at us, and then we started shouting back, and it was all heaps of fun. And I thought, oh, wow, I think that was quite formative. Looking back now, because a lot of my art is very engaging. I'm not pretending that you aren't there. The audience and I are very much in the same room. And so when I went to clown school, and that was very much the go of knowing we're in the same room, playing with that idea, listening to each other, I'm proud to say I did quite well. And so yeah, that's kind of how I've come to acquire my specific style, you could say.
And how long have you been... So, it says that you have other successes. How long have you been doing this kind of theater or performances?
Oh, wow. Well, since 2021, I'd say that was my first big kind of success in Wellington. It was a show called Milk, where audiences threw water balloons at an ensemble of improvisers. And we had six successful seasons of that across 4 years. So I think we really hit our stride in 2021, and we haven't stopped.
How does clowning work in New Zealand versus what you've seen overseas? Like, is our audience receptive enough to it?
I would say that you may very well be surprised at how receptive
That's
people
cool.
are, because when I went over there, I was lucky enough to be in class with four other New Zealanders. Imagine going to France to train, and there's New Zealanders there. But we all have this, as a culture, I think we have a cheekiness and a relaxed nature that is inherent to clowning. And so kind of people from other cultures were trying to find this thing that I think as a culture we already kind of do. So you may not think you've gone and seen clowning on a stage, but you've almost definitely seen the right kind of fun being had at work or with friends, you know?
Who inspired you along your journey?
Oh, wow. The first reason I went to clown school was a buddy of mine from undergrad. He was moving to London, as a lot of young people do once they've finished undergrad, and he was stopping off at this place in France. And I thought, well, gee, a French summer doesn't sound too bad. So I decided to join him because it was big and scary, and I've known he's wanted to move for years. And so I thought I would join him and then would have those few weeks together, and then he would continue on to London and I would come back. And so I think him taking that leap of faith and then going on that course was really eye-opening and really inspiring. So I'd say my buddy Simon, I reckon. That's number one.
That is super cool.
Yeah.
Now, should we be concerned that your writer for the show mentions that there's smashed watermelons?
That was my next question.
Was it?
How many watermelons do you have to smash to get in?
And the price of watermelons these days. I mean, if you're in Australia at 99 cents, fine. But some of the watermelons here are up to $10.
Oh my gosh. I think we figured out that this is a seasonal show. The last time we did it in November, the watermelons were up to $36. Ooh. $50 here in Wellington.
Putting them in slices.
Yes, whereas now I think they're down to a reasonable 10 or 12. At least last I checked a couple of weeks ago when we did it in the Fringe Festival. But only one watermelon, don't worry, only one. And a lucky audience member who may be so keen is the person smashing the watermelon.
Okay.
One of many little tricks you can expect.
Now I'm thinking, I could smash the watermelon right
you just
about
sold
now.
Kristen. I love it. All right, Sean, tell us all the important details. When's it on? Where can people get tickets? And you've got a choose what you pay scenario.
That's right, yep. Choose what you pay. It's on the 26th and 27th of this month, Basement Theatre, 6:30 p.m., and it's Choose What You Can, which I believe starts at $8. So if you're a $7 fan, I'm sorry, or just send me a message. I'm sure we'll figure something out for you. But we'd love to have bums and seats, you know. We're not trying to make $1 million. We're trying to have a good time.
And comedy works best when you're in that crowded room.
Well, I want to know, can you pay in watermelons?
Ooh.
Well, I'll take it, honestly.
Yeah.
The first person in my inbox with a watermelon, you get two free tickets, however many you want.
Brilliant. Love it. Head to iTicket for all the ticket information. Sean, thanks for jumping on a Sunday night and chatting to us. It sounds hilarious, and wish you all the best for your season.
Thanks so much, guys. Cheers.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Now, if you're looking for something to view this week, Auckland Theatre Company has The Homeland still playing through until the 22nd of March at the ASB Waterfront Theatre. Head to atc.co.nz for all the details. Seed is on at Titirangi Theatre, kicking off this Wednesday through to the 28th of March. This is four friends, two pregnancies, and the mother of all awkward situations. So check that out at titirangitheatre.co.nz. Phoenix Theatre and Shoreside Theatre have combined together to do Shore Shorts, and that's at the Pump House. And it's a special collaborative season bringing three compelling short plays together in one theatre experience. Each performance features all three plays, meaning you enjoy a rich trio of stories for the price of a single ticket. Perfect night out to get some variety in your day. Head to pumphouse.co.nz for all the details. And Gaslight is on at Theatre Works from the 20th to the 28th of March. It's Patrick Hamilton's classic Victorian thriller, first produced in 1935, which gave rise to the term gaslighting. It's a gripping psychological drama 91 years later. Kristen's looking terrified here. Mm. She's definitely booking for that one. Head to trybooking.com for all the details on that one. And just jumping into my bulletins page, and make sure you check out our bulletins on info@kickarts.org.nz. Comedian Sam Smoothie and Harriet Moy join Aspiring Conversations for 2026 at the Lake Wanaka Centre's Feel the Fear session on Sunday the 29th of March. Sam was raised bouncing between Cromwell and Wanaka on a path to adventure right from birth. A professional skier on the North Face Global Team, Sam has spent 20 years following winter and moving through victories on the Free Wide World Tour to filmmaking in wild locations from Bolivia to North Korea. Now, Sam is joined by folk singer and songwriter Adam McGrath and pioneering rally driver Emma Gilmore, and hosted, it must be, by Harriet Moy. So check out all the details by heading to aspiringconversations.co.nz. If you've got something coming up, make sure you email us info@kickarts.org.nz. Kristen, thanks so much for filling in. We're going to see you back here in a fortnight. Emma's back next week. We're going to close the show with my favourite group at the moment, which is Drax Project with a bit of Summer Rain. Have a wonderful week and make sure you
kick some arts.
She's like summer rain, comes and goes whenever, till she's home again. Find us storms in heaven. So I pray for rain like a guilty pleasure, till she's gone again, just like summer rain. Penny drop, aces down on the countertop. One last sip from an empty cup. One more time until I try forget. Fading light, sun slipping under the low tide. Here for the day but won't stay the night. There's another sky she needs to follow. She came home to stay, that would be crazy. But I know until that day, she's like summer rain, comes and goes whenever, till she's home again. Thunderstorms in heaven, so I pray for rain like a guilty pleasure, till she's gone again. Ooh, just like summer rain. Oh, run along, checked in late with your carry on. Left me humming a favorite song. Wonder who she'll be next time I see her. Maybelline, maybe she's born with a bigger dream. Little goldfish swimming out of sea. Oh, drifting on the breeze just like a feather. She came
home to stay. That would be crazy. But I know until that day, she's like summer rain. Comes and goes whenever, till she's home and goes whenever till she's home again. Thunderstorms in heaven, so I pray for rain like a guilty pleasure till she's gone again, just like summer rain.
We'll see you in a week. Don't forget to brush your teeth and don't forget to go to sleep. We'll be going live, same time under the stars, saying blah, 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 blah. Let's go kick some art, art, art. Go kick some art.